Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's Tuesday, the 25th of November, and it seems like a great day for a show. If we weren't doing anything else today, we would still do a show today. It's a good day for a show. We have one for you. It's right here. It just has to be realized. It's all right here, ready to go. And we're very excited to present it to you this morning. We have a fantastic group of panelists. We have a lot of really good, meaty subjects to discuss. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And this is the part of the week. This is basically hump day for this week. Because we're off Thursday and Friday, Thanksgiving, and then Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And we're still excited about the show today. That may not be the case tomorrow. So we're gonna make the best of it today. Now, let me introduce everyone to you, and we will get started. We welcome Mike Spain to the program, former Times Union Associate Editor, dear friend of this program, has been with us since, oh my gosh, the inception of this program, some 25 years ago.
You're making me sound old, Joe.
Well, we're in it together here, buddy.
I know. Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. J.P. Miller joins us from the Empire Report. What's going on, J.P.?
Joe, I'm really happy to be here. There's a lot going on, and it's a great day for a show.
It is. It's a great day for a show. Bo Breslin is Joseph Palamountain Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Happy Thanksgiving to you. It's unlikely I'll see you on Thanksgiving, but happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody in the room and all the listeners.
Well, thank you very much. I just want a quick shout out. I've done two events at Skidmore College that have included Skidmore students. Man, are they bright and wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic group, and they've gotten a lot better in the 30 years I've been there.
Yeah, they're just, we had some, really incisive questions and just a glint in the eye and ready to go. So very exciting. So
awesome.
It must be fun to work with them. Congratulations. We welcome Fran Berman to the program, Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences. That's CICS to friends. And also faculty.
The insiders.
Yes, the insiders. That's right. And they, you don't like pronounce that, right? It's still CICS. It's not like KIX.
Occasional people say KIX, but mostly CICS.
Okay. And faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman, good morning. How are you? We have missed you. It is wonderful to hear your voice.
Good morning. Good morning. And you'll miss me in December. I just talked to Sarah, our wonderful producer, about that. But on the other side of this, there'll be a book in production. So I'm eager to talk to you guys about that. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. And Joe, we can talk about traffic for an hour in case we run out of stuff to talk about.
We can always talk about traffic. When things go awry, I mentioned traffic cameras a couple of weeks ago, and man, we just 2 hours later we were still fielding the questions.
As I recall, some of the listeners said, "Oh, how refreshing that we're talking about something
non-Trump." Yes. That's right.
Yeah, non-Trump. And then other people said, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I got both
responses.
I remember the traffic reports during COVID, and they would be on the radio, and they'd say, 87 North, all clear. 87 South, all clear. And they would do it every day.
And they'd,
it was amazing.
They'd show the cameras, and there was like two cars going down. Nobody was doing anything.
No.
Yeah, it was silly.
It's like weather in California, 70 degrees. It's winter, 70 degrees. It's summer. So, yeah.
Kelly informed me over the weekend that for the holidays, she's going to pay off all of my traffic cam tickets.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Stocking stuffer.
Is that your gift?
Well, it's a big gift. Yeah.
The Albany city budget just had an infusion of funds.
It's not an insignificant gift.
Okay.
All right. Let's go, and we'll start the day. We welcome you, as always. So, well, you know, yesterday the Justice Department learned that their cases against James Comey and Letitia James have been dropped. A federal judge dismissed the criminal cases against the former FBI director and the New York State general. These were separate cases, of course, delivering an emphatic blow to President Donald Trump's rushed efforts to engineer prosecutions of two of his prominent foes. Now, U.S. District Judge Cameron McGowan Curry ruled that Lindsay Halligan, the prosecutor overseeing both cases, had been unlawfully appointed as interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, and therefore indictments she single-handedly secured against Comey and James must be thrown out. Attorney General Pam Bondi vowed that the department would pursue all available legal action, including an immediate appeal. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt dismissed Curry as another partisan judge who, she said, had taken unprecedented steps to try to intervene in accountability. The judge said the Justice Department could seek a new indictment against James under a lawfully appointed prosecutor. In Comey's case, though, Curry suggested that the time for doing so has run out. Comey's lawyers had argued that he cannot be recharged now because the five-year deadline to bring a case against him expired days after he was indicted in September. Curry appeared to endorse that view in her written opinion Monday. She cited rulings by other courts that have held that if an indictment is invalid at the time it is issued, it does not pause the clock on the statute of limitations. All actions flowing from Ms. Halligan's defective appointment, including securing and signing Mr. Comey's indictment, constitute unlawful exercises of executive power and must be set aside, the judge wrote. Ouch. There is simply no alternative course to cure this unconstitutional problem. Her decision delivered rebukes to the Justice Department on two fronts. By declaring Halligan's appointment invalid, Curry joined several other judges who have rejected the legal arguments the Trump administration had relied upon to install loyalists in top prosecutorial positions across the country. That, once again, from the Washington Post. Bo?
Joe, there's a lot of places we could start here. I think I'll start from a factual perspective and then offer a couple of different
oh, good.
Position.
Then get to the lying.
Right.
Great. Excellent.
Yeah, get to my lying. So 120 days, the legislature, Congress has passed the law that allows presidents to have interim U.S. attorneys for 120 days. And then, of course, the judge, the district court judge, appoints and continues. That 120-day period elapsed when Eric Siebert, the previous U.S. district attorney, left the position. And so the question for Judge Curry was whether or not President Trump and the attorney general can endlessly put interim U.S. attorneys in. The answer is no, right? And the reality is this is a very, it's not a technical issue like Bondi would like us to think. It's a traditional checks and balances situation. The Senate has responsibility to confirm this appointment. Otherwise, you could just endlessly put loyalists in the position. That's the underlying feature here. Let's think about a couple of other things, though, that I think are problematic. One, U.S. attorneys are considered inferior officers in the appointment and nomination and confirmation part of the Constitution. They're considered inferior officers. I am deeply worried that this conservative court is going to see Trump's ability to appoint inferior officers as representing a broader understanding of that particular clause of the Constitution. Why am I deeply worried about that? Because on July 1st, 2024, the conservative majority in the court gave Trump a lot of wiggle room, a lot of expansive power in the Trump immunity case, especially when it comes to the Department of Justice. So I'm deeply worried about this case moving its way through the Supreme Court, up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rejecting what Judge Curry has said. I'm also deeply worried about the fact that Bondi and Trump can use what they're describing as a technicality. Remember, this is a traditional separation of powers issue, but they're going to describe it, the narrative, as a technicality in order to place blame on the deep state, right? So it's another issue of the ability of the Trump administration and his loyalists to set the narrative. That narrative is going to be a narrative not only of the fact that Curry was appointed by Clinton, so she's another far-left, quote-unquote far-left judge, but also that the deep state is out to get Trump because of the fact that this is just the case was thrown out by a technicality. Letitia James is still on the hot seat because her case is not, the statute of limitations hasn't run out. Comey is less so, but I'm a little worried as this moves its way up through the appeals process that Bondi and Trump are gonna emerge a little bit victorious in some of this.
So when you say victorious, and I apologize if I missed something in what you were just describing, which was excellent, but it would be of whether the case can move forward as opposed to it actually being ruled on.
So I think that there are a couple things that an appeals court could say in this situation. One is that Halligan, who, by the way, right, remember as a footnote to this, I always have to put it in there, was the hench person for the Smithsonian. That's how she got her original job, was that she was going to
unwoke
the entire history, public-funded history of the United States. But, Joe, I think there are a couple of different ways in which an appeals court could rule that, A, Halligan was not improperly put in the position because, as an inferior officer, the president has wide latitude. Now, remember, if the appeals courts and the Supreme Court are willing to reconsider things like the Voting Rights Act, they're going to reconsider things like what it means to be an inferior officer under that particular constitutional clause. If you say that an inferior officer, Trump can endlessly put U.S. attorneys in that position for 120 days at a time, which I could see the court saying, then Halligan is not improperly in place. So I think that's the case. I also think they can pause. Joe, I think they can pause the statute of limitations because technically Halligan did get the indictment before the statute of limitations came out. So we can go back to that time and say, oh, April Fool's, Comey. The statute of limitations is now over, but at the time of the indictment, it wasn't. So I think there are lots of ways in which an appeals court and a conservative Supreme Court could interpret this poorly for James Comey and Letitia James.
Mike Spain.
It's awfully fortunate to have a constitutional law expert on the panel today. Thanks, Bo. The idea that the U.S. attorney is a what was the term? Is regarded as a
inferior officer,
therefore not requiring Senate approval and to go through the vetting that they have traditionally gone through, and the Congress would not have a role in basically approving the appointments of U.S. attorneys. That's kind of frightening, and it would let a president just go, you know, all across the country, just put in sycophants that do exactly what he or she might ask in the future. It's kind of scary. So if, and I again, I'm addressing you, Bo, if the court now says, that judge is wrong. Lindsay Halligan was properly installed and she had proper legal rights. Therefore, everything she did, the indictment, taking the case to the grand jury and getting an indictment of Comey and of Letitia James, that all goes back to there. And now it has to go through the courts. A very flimsy case that may get rejected once it gets into its merits. But how long do you think it's going to take for all this to play out?
I think it'll play out by the end of the term. So I think Comey can rest comfortably for about 6 months.
Yeah.
Oh, good. He could write another mystery.
Hey, can I interrupt with
absolutely
a piece of
written? Yes.
Whoa. So I'm just fascinated by what everybody is saying, and I'm so grateful that we have experts on the show today about this. But I have to say, as an expert in something completely different, I'm just sort of excited to see this, our beleaguered and imperfect system, fighting back. I mean, apparently we've redefined partisan as people who uphold the law, but okay. But the system's kind of punching back at this random and destructive behavior. So, I just have three words for this: way to go. I do think that, there's all these sort of terrible things that can happen, but today we should feel good that this happened because it was the right thing to do.
J.P. Miller.
Bo, you've done a great job enlightening us all. Tell me, do you think? All right, so let's assume that the Supreme Court says Halligan was properly installed. Do you see these cases going to court, or do you see maybe one that's likely to go to trial and one that's maybe not likely to go to trial?
Well, that's a great question. I can't imagine, J.P., that they wouldn't go to trial, that both of them wouldn't just follow the same path. I mean, part of Trump's modus operandi is public embarrassment of his enemies. So the more public a trial is, the better off he is.
Yep. And what do you think? What do you think about them being found guilty? Possible.
Zero. Oh, well, not zero, but very low.
Very low.
I mean, there is a reason why Eric Siebert jumped ship and said that there's no there with Comey.
And he was a Trump appointment.
He was a Trump
and
appointment.
And he saw nothing there and was pushed out because he wouldn't bring these indictments.
Right.
So when you are when you think about this, it's obviously no surprise that it's going to be appealed. But do they, and I don't know exactly how this can or does work, but do they also try to find someone else other than Halligan to?
Yes. I mean, they need to, there has to be a U.S. attorney in there. So the
right.
You've got to find someone else.
They're saying she wasn't. Well, they're saying that she wasn't that she wasn't presented correctly, right? Or are they saying that she doesn't have the credentials to actually do it?
No. So what Judge Curry is saying, there are a couple of things that are super interesting here. And before I list those off, Fran, you're absolutely right. I did a jig when Curry came out with her opinion yesterday. I thought it was a real slap in the face.
That's when I wish we worked in television. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
So I think I think there are a couple of things that are super interesting here. If you look at the appointment letter from Bondi for Lindsay Halligan, she has a workaround. Bondi has a workaround, right? She appoints Halligan as U.S. attorney, but in the event that there's something technically wrong with that appointment, she also, in that same appointment letter, Bondi also appoints her as special attorney, right? So read between the lines. Bondi absolutely understood that she could, that this appointment could run afoul of the law. So, otherwise, she would not have included the additional way in which you can make Lindsey Halligan bring the indictment against Comey and so on. So, Joe, there's going to be someone in there. One of the problems that Halligan faced was that she went in to seek the indictment alone, and she had no prosecutorial experience. And so there
can
is.
Can you explain a little bit more about that? Because that was the part. I mean, usually there's a lead prosecutor, but apparently it's a message if there's only one prosecutor. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'm happy to talk a little bit about that. I will always tell my listeners that I am not a lawyer, though I apparently play one on WAMC's roundtable.
Unless there are other lawyers around,
right,
then
exactly.
You have to keep it in check.
That I have to defer. I'm just a constitutional guy. That said, Fran, so it is highly unusual for only a single prosecutor, especially one who's been on the job for 2 days, to be seeking the indictment, because it's complicated and there are other elements that the government wants to make as part of the equation. Here we are. Remember, there's that other case, that other technical problem that Halligan faced, which was alerted to by the judge 2 weeks ago, that she sought the change in the indictment by only going to the foreman of the grand jury. So she's making mistakes left and right. This is and lots of people will argue, including Comey, that she is she's not qualified for the gig. Right. That said, it's still an appointment by the president. So all of these things have contributed to Comey's defense. Some are more valuable than others. Curry's 120-day the opinion that says she only has that the 120 days has elapsed. That's the most constitutionally concrete way to get her off the case.
Oh, super interesting. Thank you. Yeah, it seemed to me that, I mean, the fact that we were just looking at law and procedure done inappropriately and incorrectly, and kind of standing that up to say, look, we've got this system. It's pretty imperfect. It's pretty beleaguered. It's often biased. It's still the system we've got. And to use that system to actually make some progress, well, in my opinion, progress. I don't know. For me, that gave me a little smile, maybe a big smile.
But will she continue to be U.S. attorney?
At this point, the answer is no, JP. I mean, she can't stay on because she's...
She can't stay on.
She cannot stay on.
So the judge yesterday essentially declared her appointment as invalid and essentially said she's not the U.S. attorney.
Okay, but so they're going to then appoint another invalid U.S. attorney
So this is the thing. Yeah. The 120 days is over. If we assume that it's over, and Pam Bondi knows that that was a potential problem for her, the U.S. District Court judge is the appointer. It's not the Attorney General anymore if the 120 days is over. Now, typically, this is not unusual. 120 days elapses. The U.S. District Court judge is typically going to just reappoint the person that the president
wants. I thought
that
that's what usually happens, right?
Yes.
Is this what John Sarcone in the Northern District of New York ran into?
Yes.
Same thing.
Yes.
But somehow Sarcone's still there. So you're saying that he's there illegally as well?
That's the question, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. The answer, I'll say this, JP. Three other places around the country you've had the judge throw out the U.S. district attorney because of this problem. I think Sarcone has that problem, but at the end of the day, that case hasn't come up before. So it's not unprecedented. What makes Lindsey Halligan interesting from a public perspective is they're going after Comey and Letitia James, right? Some of these other ones, they're not going after high-profile people. So, but this is happening around the country because the Trump administration and Pam Bondi want to bypass congressional rule, the 120-day rule, to to keep their loyalists in office.
So the reason she was appointed improperly is because of who she prosecuted, not because of the process by which she was appointed.
No, she was what makes her, whatever she has done, according to Judge Curry, illegal is because the process was not followed. Not, it's just high profile in the press because it's Comey and Letitia James.
Yeah, it should be noted, too, that Sarcone, the U.S. attorney designee in Albany, who sits in Albany, Letitia James is trying to have his position invalidated also because he's been investigating her also. So, I mean, it gets into the whole, and I don't want to use the word technicality. It gets into the whole way that the courts look at the way that this has been going on for centuries? Or, I mean, is this the...
Fact of the matter, as long as we've had U.S. attorneys, you've had to follow the process, the traditional checks and balances process, which is nomination by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And if you want to bypass the confirmation by the Senate, Congress has said, okay, we want to keep the wheels of justice going. You can have 100... President, you can have 120 days to put your person in. But after that, no, Congress needs to review these appointments. That's the Madisonian checks and balances at work. And that's been going on since 1787 or 1789 when we had the ratification.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll dig into this some more. We'll welcome your letters and much more. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Listening to the music of Jimmy Cliff this morning, and a reggae star passed away yesterday at the age of 81, a Grammy award-winning singer, an actor. Jimmy Cliff passed away, and we will be remembering Jimmy Cliff with the music coming into our breaks. We also remind you that you can go to our playlist, which is found at wamc.org/roundtable, to see all of the tracks that we will play. But a sad day, but amazing music left behind. And Jimmy Cliff, dead at 81, we will hear lots of great music this morning. Let's move on to continuing our conversation about what is happening when it comes to the case from the judge saying no on this. we've got a nice letter from Michael who said, exceptional substantive discussion this morning. Thank you very much. And then I'm wondering as to when I'm not tying these together yet, but you see these cases withering. They haven't died yet, but there is a withering process. And then on the same day, they're like, okay, let's go after Mark Kelly. And I'm sort of, you would think at a point where it becomes so obvious, and also that they really don't have anything. Now, I realize that they have won, they have gotten their way. Trump has gotten his way on many cases where every lawyer in the country said, there's no way in hell you're going to win this. Mm-hmm. But they didn't, but they settled. But in this case, I just wonder if it will have an overall effect.
No.
That's what I was afraid of.
Others?
No. You talked about Marjorie Taylor Greene yesterday.
Yes.
A lot, but some see her defiance and her willingness to stand up to Trump and the other Republicans who stood up to Trump, with the Epstein files, and others are standing up to Trump on his declaration that federal workers are not covered by union contracts. And now there seems to be a building opposition from Republicans to a federal like, you know, the federal government superseding state government on regulating AI. I mean, there's all these little withering, using your term, Joe, steps that are happening. Perhaps this is, and this is not my analysis, but some have suggested this is the beginning of the end of the sort of Trump reign. He's going to be more of a lame duck, and more Republicans will be emboldened to quietly, politely turn away from him and go other ways. I don't know. I think if I'm correct, we've probably had a similar conversation many times in the last few years, that people are finally turning away from Trump, that people are finally tired of him, that the MAGA is getting worn out or evolving away from their leader at the current time, and it'll have a new life after he goes. But I don't know. You know, it seems like deja vu when I say something like that.
Indeed.
Joe, I think this is an easy one.
Okay.
I don't know whether it's going to make a difference. Do you know what's not going to make a difference?
What?
Not doing anything. You know, it's like every time we do something tiny, they mount up. And, you know, maybe it mounts up in a noticeable way, and maybe it doesn't, and maybe you need more things, but that doesn't make any of these things a valuable thing to do. So I just don't think we even have a choice. You just keep doing stuff. And eventually that stuff, you know, will make a difference if enough people do it and, you know, enough rules get examined and enough people kind of punch back a little bit. Not doing it is just not an option.
There is something to, I'm going to go back to Fran's optimism for a moment, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's optimism, but it's reality.
No, but your earlier statement thought was optimistic, which is. The case of, oh, you know what? No one else will take these cases. Like, we found Halligan because everyone else said, I got a bus to catch. I'm going to Florida for 2026. Like, these were career professionals who looked at this and said, no, thank you. And I do wonder of where that fits into. I guess you can always find somebody, but aren't you always then going to run into the many of the same problems that we've run into with Halligan?
Yeah, but I don't think it matters to this administration. What's so many things? I'll say a couple things here, Joe. One is being a U.S. attorney. Right, there are 94 districts in this country. Being a U.S. attorney in one of those is the pinnacle of people's career. And there are, I don't know, 1,000, 1,500 U.S. attorneys out there that have at one time occupied the position. It's about as good as it gets when it comes to the legal profession. And they, by putting Halligan in there, never been a prosecutor, was... sort of hitched her wagon to Trump's personal lawyer team because he picked her out of a party at Mar-a-Lago. And to say that she is at the level of the U.S. attorney is disrespectful to those people who are U.S. attorneys and have been in the past. The second thing I'll say about this is all the stories that are swirling around and that we will possibly get to if we have the time are all in some way connected, right? So what another interesting element to this is the leak that came out this morning about the fact that Hegseth, our Secretary of Defense, I refuse to call him Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense is now refusing to let the Scouts of America participate because of the fact that they've, quote unquote, gotten too woke because we let girls into the Scouts of America. That combined with what is happening to Comey, what the Hegseth is going after Mark Kelly. These are all attempts to sort of throw anything at the wall and hope something sticks. Some of this stuff is not going to stick, but it's a consistent narrative, a consistent strategy on the part of the Trump administration to go after institutions and people who do the types of things that that Trump's base disagrees with.
Anybody else? All right. Let's. I find it also interesting. Not that it's a. We welcome your letters. We haven't gotten a lot of letters on this, which I thought we would get more, but that's interesting to me. Anyway, but we do have this one from Liz. Hi, panel. It seems obvious that no one in the DOJ/Virginia was willing to work with Halligan versus Comey and James. So how will anyone find a willing substitute? Well, that was sort of my question, but they'll find somebody.
Oh, for sure. There's, what's idiotic to me, sorry, I think I'm being a little extreme. I'm a little fired up today. Sorry, Joe. But what's idiotic to me is Bondi putting Halligan in when there are actually competent lawyers who will do Trump's bidding that they could have found. But I think they got, you know, they either got lazy or they thought that Halligan would fall into line. There are lawyers out there who want that job and who will do Trump's bidding. So that's not going to be a problem.
But I still think there's an outstanding question as to whether these U.S. attorneys like Sarcone, is Sarcone going to stay in office now?
Yeah, I think a lot. There's going to be a lot of turnover.
But when you say a lot of turnover, is he's basically in there under the same process that Halligan was in, and there's two or three others. So what, they're going to continue to do their jobs, and you think everything that they do is going to be negated by judges?
Yeah. So JP, I mean that's the million-dollar question, and the answer is, let's think about it. Right. One of the things that the Supreme Court said, I don't know, Joe, what was it, a year ago now, when the Supreme Court said that. You can't have universal or widespread, what's the term? This was the birthright citizenship case that where they didn't talk about birthright citizenship, JP, but they talked about, I'll come up with the term. The reality is you could get a lawyer in Sarcone's case, a judge in Sarcone's case, who will interpret the congressional statute more broadly than Curry interpreted it, or more favorably towards the administration than Curry did. And in that case, Sarcone's work is going to be totally validated. So
even though they were appointed under the exact same...
Yes, until it makes its way out. I mean, the Court of Appeals in this country, the federal courts of appeals in this country have a lot of power. But until it makes its way up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says either yes or no to this type of broad base. And I don't mean to be litigious, but I'll throw one more thing out on the table here. I don't mean to be, sort of professorial. But the Supreme Court, the justices... Historically, this dates back about 100 years, historically have approached these types of cases in one of two ways. Either what we call a formalist approach, where the Constitution tells you literally what to do, and if you don't follow it, it's whatever is illegal. That's what Curry is saying. This is a formalist approach. There's also a whole contingent of Supreme Court justices who we would describe as functionalist, who will interpret a law like the congressional law that says 120 days it can be interpreted expansively or not depending on the circumstances of the situation. And you had really famous justices who were functionalist, like Felix Frankfurter and so on. He's like, yeah, the gloss of life is such that we can let the president do what he wants to do when he's seizing the steel mills, although Frankfurter did not in that case. And then you have very prominent justices like Chief Justice Berger, who's like, oh, no, got to follow exactly the law of the land. Curry is in the formalist. But if you get a functionalist judge who's like, well, we can read this broadly, then Sarcone gets to keep doing what he's doing.
I'm sorry, the gloss of life?
Yes. Felix Frankfurter was like, you know, you've got...
I like that.
Yeah, he's said justices have to consider whether or not the gloss of life has made it so that a president, in this case, can do things that maybe the Constitution doesn't necessarily allow.
Nails wants to know who's paying for these indictments.
Taxpayer.
Yeah.
We are.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way this works. Then we got this from Amy. Good morning, and thanks for this informative panel on a muddy subject. Every time these Trumpish and Trump lawsuits are discussed, I think, remember when Republicans were grandstanding about frivolous lawsuits 24/7? How the worm has turned. Mark Kelly, Comey, James explained Trump attempting to bury Epstein. Carry on with the great work. Well, I mean, I don't disagree with that fully, but I'm pretty sure that Epstein or no Epstein, he still would have gone after his enemies, right?
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, I love. I mean, it's so interesting. The timing is such that, you know, did they know that Curry was going to render her decision last night, just as Pete Hegseth decides to go after Mark Kelly and the Scouts of America, and Epstein was just a week or two before? No. So it's part of the chaos of Washington at the moment.
I think that the word chaos is, you know, planned chaos is exactly what's going on. They're throwing, as you said, Bo, they're throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks. And then the question is, does the public perceive this as, you know, this Judge Curry's decision yesterday as her, you know, she's just a liberal appointed by Bill Clinton, and that's to be expected, and, you know, it's going back and forth, or does the public perceive that as significant and stamping down what Trump tried to do with the indictments of both Comey and Letitia James. How does the public see it? And you had said something earlier, and I think we've all acknowledged it. I mean, this gives Trump and, you know, Pam Bondi and Trump's spokespeople a talking point. Yeah. You know, and how does the public, and your listener just said this is a very complicated case. And so how does the public who hears just fragments of this perceive it? And what does it end up meaning? Do they think that Democrats are going after Trump, or do they think the liberal judges are going after Trump? Do they think the deep state is erupting and trying to stamp down Trump, you know, or is that getting,
Don't you think the public is just tired of all of this? I mean, we're just tired of all of this, you know, we're tired of prices going up. We're tired of being afraid. We're tired of, students not being able to go to college, you know, without being distracted by all this stuff. We're just tired of it all. And every time somebody punches back, you know, a lot of us think, okay, you know, when's it going to start really making a difference? But every little bit helps. So
I'm tired.
I don't know. I mean, I just think the public is tired of this.
I'm tired of it, Fran. I will say, though, that it pays the bills. Political scientists are having their moment in the sun at the moment. So, but I'm tired of it. Yeah, and I think a lot of people are.
But is the result, Fran, as people are tired of it, do they want to engage, or are they just going to withdraw from the whole process and just look at this chaos, which is very effective? I mean,
Well, I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself. You know, as the centrist, you know, among pretty much every panel I'm on, because I do think I think these are complicated issues, and there are pros and cons to everything. And also, I mean, this is just a caveat. Also, I think there are different ways of approaching government. You know, my own beliefs sort of put me more on the side of the public interest and a big social safety net. There's a lot of people who don't want to see a big social safety net. Some of those folks have really interesting arguments. So,
you know, if you think about it, you know, how has my own behavior changed over the last 10 months? And, you know, not only am I tired of it, but I'm just tired of seeing really cruel and bad things happening to a lot of groups who don't deserve it. And, you know, so has that made me a little bit more focused on what I can do? Yeah. In my job as an educator, I want to be really careful because it's not my job to tell students what to think, but I really want them to be thoughtful, really. And so I've been working hard on that. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, how can I be helpful in the next set of elections? So as many people can vote as possible. So, you know, I have to say my own behavior is getting more and more in terms of just being discouraged. Okay, maybe I've hit the bottom. Hopefully I've hit the bottom. And I'm trying to figure out what I can do for my community and for my state and, you know, on the national space. But I think everybody's going through their own trajectory on this. And I do think, you know, it's just it's sort of a national process we're all going through. And by the way, there's a bunch of people in the country who are really delighted by this. And I try not to forget about that because those people are not a different species. We are related to them. We work with them. You know, we're in communities with them. And to let all this stuff come between us, which it really has, I think isn't the right way. So, you know, I think we both have to be more understanding and more activist myself. But, you know, I don't know. I am tired of it.
We'll take a break. We are very late for a break. We will go to that right now and we'll return right after this. I am sure. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It is the 25th of November, and we have a fantastic group. Fran Berman is with us, Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences. Joseph Palamountain, Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bill Breslin is here. J.P. Miller of the Empire Report joins us, as does Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let's move on slightly to, I just want to quickly talk about the Mark Kelly case, because we really haven't, on the show, we didn't discuss this at any great length, which is the video that caused all of this. The Pentagon has launched an investigation into Mark Kelly after purportedly receiving serious allegations of misconduct, quote unquote, against the Democratic senator from Arizona. An extraordinary use of authority to investigate a combat veteran and a prominent critic of the Trump administration. The announcement Monday follows a video posted last week in which Kelly and five other Democratic colleagues reminded U.S. service members of their duty to disobey unlawful orders responding to concerns within the armed forces and Congress that the Pentagon strikes against alleged drug smugglers around Latin America violate the laws of war. Their foolish screed sows doubt and confusion, which only puts our warriors in danger, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said in a social media post responding to the Pentagon's initial statement announcing the probe. Hegseth said Kelly is the only lawmaker of the six who falls under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and thus is the only one being investigated. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Kelly wrote in a social media post, "If this is meant to intimidate me or other members of Congress from doing our jobs and holding this administration accountable, it won't work." The Pentagon probe dramatically escalates the Trump administration's ongoing use of legal and public pressure against critics of its lethal counter-narcotic strikes. Last week, President Donald Trump posted that the six members of Congress involved in the video had committed sedition, actions he later said were punishable by death, and there was a noose meme included. Mike.
Well, I guess under this technicality that only Mark Kelly falls under of the six members of Congress who signed this or made the statements, he could be called into active duty still. He's still eligible. The former astronaut could be called into active duty and then court-martialed. And all of this would be playing out in a military court, and whether his comments were indeed something that might be covered by free speech and might be correct and legally correct might also have endangered service members who are confused about what their role is. And I get that. I as much as I admire the way that they stood together to make this assertion, it's difficult, and I can only imagine how difficult it is in the military if you're following orders and your commander tells you to do something. I think of Vietnam and the Major Kelly, who led a massacre in Vietnam. Whether the service members should have revolted or should have they, what should they have done if their commander is saying go in and slaughter women and children because this is what I'm telling you to do? There are cases where commanders have made dead wrong decisions, no pun intended, and it is confusing to a service member whose whole training is to follow the line of chain of command. So I get why they say it's confusing, but to use the court-martial as a method to suppress a member of Congress, and a stellar military career, and gosh, the guy went to space. It just shows you how Trump will throw anything at his opponents and do anything he can to discredit his opponents and cost them politically and cost them, cause stress, you name it. And that's why a lot of people don't speak up like these six members of Congress do.
Fran.
I don't know. I look at these things and I think they must be from The Onion. But, after 10 months of this, it seems impossible. So I looked at the video and it was, some nice, catchy video that said, uphold the law. So I'm just trying to figure out what the problem is. We should uphold the law. The military should uphold the law. If someone tells you to do something illegal, if I get stopped for a traffic stop and, the policeman, says go kill that person over there, I should not do that. So that's what the video did. And, it's like more of the same, trying to punish people, trying to incite people, returning to my previous statement, I'm just sick of it, And here's something that I think, I don't know how the rest of you feel, but imperfect and complicated as it is, I used to kind of trust my government. And, I'm not sure what to trust anymore. Mm. And I really hate that because, this is the country I live in. I love this country. My children were brought up in this country. I'm happy to live in this country. I want to trust my country. And, this kind of nonsense goes on. And really, it's just kindergarten-level nonsense. I'm not happy about it. And I don't think there's anything wrong in the video.
JP?
I thought the video from the senators was silly and misguided. But, senators make silly videos all the time on the internet. And the president did not need to amplify it the way in the way that he did. I think that his response, talking about punishable by death, is outrageous. We have a problem with political violence in this country, and it has gotten worse over the last decade rather than better. And a lot of people, me included, anticipate it getting worse political violence in the next 10 years. And what he did by amplifying this was actually make this a bigger issue in the military, which you want it to be less of an issue in the military. The last thing that we need is to have a politicized military. And how Hegseth is going to deal with Kelly, I think it's a bad look. Hegseth is not a credible, you know, Secretary of Defense. And the more active he gets and the more he's in the news, my view is that it hurts him rather than helps him.
Yeah, and I agree with all three of my fellow panelists on this. What's interesting to me, in addition to what has been said, are a couple of things. One is military folks take an oath to the Constitution, right? Not to their commander and so on, right? That's part of the equation here, is that if you see something illegal or if you see something unconstitutional, your oath is to the Constitution. Secondly, JP's right. Political violence in this country is out of control. But the president has the biggest bullhorn in the political violence arena. And so for whether we think, and I thought it was fine, I didn't think it was silly, but whether we think the video is, one thing or another, it is an entirely escalated, different ball game when the president comes out and threatens the possibility of, punishment by death. That's a different ball game, and I think it's important. How many of us remember Elon Musk criticizing Kelly back in March when Kelly criticized the administration for being isolationist in the Ukraine battle? Elon Musk went to town. This is my last comment on this topic is when Musk did that and when Trump is doing this to Kelly, in light of the fact that Kelly is sacred American. He's Americana, right? He not only went to space, but he's the Democratic heir to the McCain seat in that. And McCain is a hero. It says something to me about the political short-sightedness of the GOP and the Trump administration when they're going after what is as American as apple pie. And Mark Kelly is that. Mark Kelly has a good shot of being a serious contender for the Democratic 2028 presidential election. He thought about it for 2024. He's going to consider it for 2028. And the GOP is so short-sighted that they're going to put him on a platform and people are going to feel sorry for him. It's just a bad political strategic move on Hegseth's part. So it says to me that there's not a long-term strategy here with regard to at least the politics of it. And by the way, Fran, I'm totally with you. I tend to be the I'll just say this as a footnote. I tend to be the guy who's sort of anti-Trump. But I've said on this show so many times, I'm Pete Buttigieg, right? I'm not AOC or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. I'm quite moderate. It's just frustrating to see American politics decay in the way that I've seen it over the last many years.
I was just going to add, too.
I mean, honestly, thank you for saying that. I mean, I just think that, sorry to be the discouraged Pollyanna here, but there's supposed to be room for all kinds of points of view.
For sure.
And, just as abominable as I find, the far right point of view, like my own point of view, it depends. On the situation. I mean, our very patient listeners have heard me say that all kinds of different times, and I'm usually talking about tech. And, today's tech, of course, is AI, AI, AI all the time. And, you use that same analysis on AI. AI can be really wonderful, and, if we assume it's a different species who's going to be our overlord, we're serving ourselves poorly. So, centrist I am, and I appreciate you saying that.
When it comes to Kelly, I mean, they said because he was the only one because of his military service, which just makes it worse, right? I mean, it's not only is this guy a veteran, a decorated veteran, but also an astronaut.
And the victim of political violence in his family.
And yeah. His wife has an attempted assassination. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't seem like... I'm not saying that that gives you carte blanche to do whatever you want. But as far as from petty nonsense, that seems to be just a bridge too far when you have... okay, do you agree with him politically? No, maybe not. In Trump's case, but do you go after this guy who is sort of like the just the gold standard when it comes to what you want someone to do for your country?
That's right. You know, if I would like my child, my 27-year-old daughter, to grow up like Mark Kelly. You know, the fact of the matter is. That's real. The other thing that's important to remember here and that we tend to forget is that dissent, disagreement with government, distrust of government, as Fran mentioned, is the blood that runs through the liberal project of America. It is the purpose. We dissented at the American Revolution as the centerpiece of what why we're here. And so for Mark Kelly to disagree with some of the policies and then get intimidated and essentially the noose metaphor strikes me as anti-American in the gravest sense.
All right. Anyone else? Okay, we'll move on. My thanks to everyone. I do want to see what kind of letters we get here. Even though it's not going to happen, what makes this great of what makes this threat of court martial and execution for Kelly particularly egregious is that the man's wife experienced political violence. That's what Mike was just saying, and is still suffering from the results. It's absolutely disgusting.
You know, can I just add too? You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene in her long statement about why she was going to leave Congress, and you know, you can go back and forth on what the real motivations are, et cetera. But you know, she has been now getting threats of political violence. When the president, from his bully pulpit, gets up and
that too,
Freudian term slip there. When he gets on the bully pulpit and criticizes people and calls them awful and suggests they might be deserving of the death penalty, there's crazy people out there who say, yeah, man, and they go out and act. I mean, think about Josh Shapiro. You know, think about other people who've been victimized. And I mean, I remember Mitt Romney in the final year or two that he was senator. He had to have a bodyguard. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and the condemnation.
You know what, Mike? At UMass, and this is at every single place, you have to take these conflict of interest modules, you know, to make sure you're doing stuff on the up and up, you know, or educators, and we're supposed to be doing things with high integrity. So I'm taking UMass's module. Let me just say this is boring in the public thing. And taking the module and every single, and this thing is like a half hour, 45 minutes, I forget. And every single thing it tells me I am not supposed to be doing as an employee of the University of Massachusetts, the state, you know, university, my president has done like a billion times. And so I'm going through this thing and I'm saying, like, why do these conflict of interests, good behavior, high integrity stuff, why does this apply to me, but this doesn't apply to the leader of my country? And honestly, I don't have a good reason for this. And honestly, if I did something really terrible, you know, UMass would come after me, as probably they should. Like, who's coming after this guy? It just, you know, it's in this sort of in the onion land that we all live in. It's just, hard to imagine.
It is, absolutely. JP, do you have anything? Okay. I just wanted to check. I didn't want you to go without.
No. I'm I couldn't ever imagine Fran doing anything nefarious. So I would...
Nor I.
Well,
I agree with you.
Not on purpose, anyway.
Yes, not intentionally, certainly. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Oh, we'll talk about this Russia thing coming up with Ukraine and Russia and peace agreements, question mark. We will see, and we welcome your letters on that as well. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Man, you could just listen to that for a long time, couldn't you? And we did, but that's okay. It was just good stuff. Jimmy Cliff, the late reggae star, passed away at the age of 81, remembering him this morning on the program. All right, we have letters. I'm going to get back to those. I want to get to some other topics, and then we'll move on to I'll go back to the letters, I think, I promise. we'll see how it goes. I think we're okay. All right. So as Ukraine sets red lines, a U.S. peace plan is slimmed down. We were talking during the break amongst us here about the coverage of this story, because it does seem to be all over the place that there great progress has been made, but they're not going to go for this. They're not going to go for that. But the talks have been substantive, and the talks have been optimistic. And so I do think it's important, and I have chosen one story, but we'll see what you know. I think it's important to keep in mind as to where we are on this particular case. So Russia right now, Russia is bombarding Kyiv, even as Ukraine claims progress in peace talks. This latest attack killed at least 7 people, the authorities said, as an official suggested that President Volodymyr Zelensky was ready to go to Washington, D.C. Missile and drone strikes on Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, killed at least 7 people, injured at least 20 others, according to the city's mayor. The attack came as Ukraine and some of its non-U.S. allies, a so-called coalition of the willing, were scheduled to meet by video conference to discuss the peace efforts and security guarantees for Ukraine. The Secretary General of NATO said is expected to join the discussion. Last night, Russia launched another attack at a time when Ukraine, together with America, Europe, and many others around the world, are working virtually around the clock to stop the bloodshed, said Mr. Zelensky on social media. Ukraine also carried out strikes on Russia overnight, hitting several regions, and the local governor there saying one of the longest and biggest attacks since Wednesday, when a Russian missile strike killed at least 39 people. There has been a relative lull in attacks on Ukraine beyond the front lines. Many Ukrainians were bracing for another large-scale assault despite the recent flurry of diplomatic activity. A driver in Ukraine says, well, to me, it doesn't look like they're agreeing on anything. And so there's that. And then you have what's happening at the at the White House, but it is happening with the administration. Secretary of State Marco Rubio holding a series of meetings in Geneva over the weekend about a 28-point peace proposal for Ukraine and Russia. And meanwhile, the president has set a deadline of Thursday, a quote-unquote hard deadline. And by Monday, that deadline was gone. The 28-point plan, which was widely criticized as a series of one-sided concessions to President Vladimir Putin, had been shrunk to closer to 19 or 20 points. Some of the most sensitive elements, including limits on the size of the Ukrainian military and a proposed ban on basing NATO troops inside Ukraine, were set aside, for future negotiation. That coverage from the New York Times, including reporting from David Sanger. But
I'm going to channel Fran's realism here, which I think is very wise. No, because I think it's easy. In this moment, I think it's easy. This is complicated stuff. And I'm going to focus a little bit on Rubio, because I think it's easy to completely go down the rabbit hole of bashing the Trump administration for offering up a 28-point plan that largely was crafted by Moscow, right, by the Kremlin. So I'm going to I want to be more realistic here. I actually think there's a great New York Times article about how today about how Rubio was trying to save what was essentially a train driving off the tracks. So my understanding, and this is the realism part, my understanding is that a lot of the peace plan, what we now describe as the 28-point peace plan, the original peace plan, was crafted with the Witkoffs and the Kushners of the world in Mar-a-Lago, or at least in Florida, and it leaked, right? So when something leaks, it takes on a life of its own. And Rubio was trying to get it back. This is my optimistic side. This is my realistic side. I do not think that Rubio, as Secretary of State, anticipated that the 28-point Kremlin-endorsed or at least Kremlin-written peace plan was going to be the final product ever. And now he had to scramble to figure out a way in which to bring Ukraine more into the conversation. So do I think there is progress that's being made on this? Yes, I think there's progress that's being made on it. I do think there are some red lines that the Trump administration has to understand that Ukraine cannot give up. One is a loss of sovereignty, which means a loss of territory. Two is reduction in the military. Three is the big one is you have to take off the table that NATO is never a possibility for Ukraine. That cannot be. And if I'm Marco Rubio and I'm the Trump administration, I don't even consider that as a possibility, recognizing that Putin may walk from the table. The other thing that I think is last thing I'll say is that Europe has to be part of this conversation, and the Trump administration does have a tendency to be a bull in a china shop when it comes to Europe. They don't take Europe seriously, and Europe is part of this, an equal partner in the Ukraine, Russia, United States, Europe. They're all equal partners here. You cannot ignore Europe's role in this negotiation.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, as Trump as this was rolled out, this 28-point plan that was quite favorable to Russia's perspective, Trump did say that if Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine didn't agree, he could fight his little heart out without any U.S. Help. And that's a pretty heavy threat. But what was impressive to me was how Zelensky handled that. He said, well, we have we have hard choices ahead. We have to decide our future, our sovereignty, and we have to evaluate our relationship with our strongest ally. And he said there may be points to consider, and there may be something in here that we can work with. And I thought that's the art of diplomacy, something that has been left out of this entire escapade that's been going on. You have to wonder how difficult it must be for Zelensky. He's facing another big scandal in his country where there's a lot of corruption, and he's trying to hold it all together. And he's been at war for 3 years, and he's able to manage Trump a little bit. And I think that his response enabled, Rubio, as you say, Bo, to pull this a little bit back on track and make it something that might be possible, and I sure hope there is an end to this war, as everyone does.
JP?
I agree with my other two panelists. They did a great job. The only thing I would add is that, you know, in addition to everybody wanting this war over, I do feel like Ukraine wants this war over more than Russia does. And by virtue of that, and Russia is the superpower compared to Ukraine, and there are going to be significant concessions in pro-Russia, you know, parts of the deal that are going to have to be accepted for the war to end. And Zelensky's job is to minimize those and obviously get the best deal that he can, or choose to stay at war. You know, it's his call. But I think having the White House focused on this, having Moscow and having Zelensky focus on us, hopefully we are in the weeks and months phase of ending this rather than years.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I agree with everybody, and I really appreciate the thoughtfulness. I mean, at the end of the day, the peace plan can't be worse than the war, right? And so Zelensky and Ukraine have to really be working with all of the parties to make sure that this is actually an improvement. I sort of agree about the Europe and NATO stuff. I mean, Ukraine, as someone in the article said, you know, they should be able to choose their own allies. I mean, that seems to me like a fundamental set of agency and rights for Ukraine. I think it's also true that the U.S. threats are not consistent. You know, they kind of change over time based on, you know, who's involved and what their mood is and stuff like that. So that makes it a little bit more difficult, an already difficult situation, a little bit more difficult in terms of trying to, you know, play out what various options are.
I think there are a couple.
But, yeah, as everybody else, I'm really hopeful that this actually gets sorted out. And I think if the U.S. could be an influence in that and a positive influence in that, that would be great, really great.
I want to hear your thoughts, Bo. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We'll hear from Bo, get some letters, and we will be done for the panel section this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this.
If the lover in you can touch the lover in the lover in me, can touch a lover in you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us as we finish up our conversation on this Tuesday morning. We've been talking about Russia and Ukraine. Bo, you wanted to make a very good point, I believe.
Yeah, I just want to make one more point, Joe, and that is I think the timing is unfortunate given that there are the corruption scandals that are now sort of haunting Zelensky. So I think he actually is in a weaker position. He's sort of behind the eight ball a little bit more today than he was a few weeks ago because, you know, Ukraine has a long history of corruption, and he cleaned it up, and now it's starting to haunt him again. So I actually think he's weaker today, and that's really unfortunate.
And how does that change things? I mean, given the corruption that I don't know. I mean, it's sort of been a part of the equation, right?
Yeah, I think it changes things in two ways. The one is domestically, because you know, there's this great journalist, a guy named Paul Hockenis, whose family is Saratogian. They grew up in the area, and he has spent a year in Ukraine. He really knows what he's talking about. And he traveled around, and he found domestically that almost everybody is willing to sacrifice mightily for the cause, partly because Zelensky is so influential and inspiring. And so when you have the people around him engaging in the type of corruption that really was disparaging for Ukrainians for so many years as they tried to be more, quote unquote, European, Paul Hockenis notes that domestically that faith is in Zelensky is chipped away at. And then internationally, anytime you have your people that are engaged in, and there's no evidence that he's engaged in corruption, but your people engaged in corruption, it just puts you in a weaker negotiating position with a strong-armed Putin and an equally autocratic, or at least would-be autocratic, Trump. Europe is Zelensky's real ally, but I think internationally he's a little weaker today because of the corruption as well.
All right, let's go to letters. I was going to, instead of taking on a new topic, we have a lot of letters on a lot of the topics that we talked, many of the topics that we talked about, and I would like to get to those. And we begin with Allison, who says, regarding the video to the military, if the courts can't figure out what is legal or illegal, how can individual members of the armed services make the distinction? When I first heard the video, I thought it was great, but now I don't think so.
Can I quickly comment?
Yes, please.
Remember, the video is in response to the killing of Venezuelan boaters. There is every reason to believe that that's not necessarily legal. So that's what those six folks were talking about.
And that the military should not obey those orders.
Correct.
Carl says Senator Kelly is being investigated for military misconduct for quoting the military code of conduct. We couldn't make this stuff up. How does this look for Trump and Hegseth? Well,
that's because we live in Onion Land.
Yes,
I'm telling you, for those of you guys that don't read The Onion, this is definitely it's a satire magazine.
It happened,
and it's definitely from the headlines.
It happened to me over the weekend, and I can't think of the headline, but Andy Borowitz did a headline, and I thought it was real. I didn't see Andy's name, and then I saw it, and I was like, oh. That's happening, and then I realized, oh, that isn't true.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, folks, when you can't tell fact from fiction anymore.
It tells you a lot.
Well, that was the whole idea, actually, behind all this, to confuse us, and it's working.
And indeed they have. Corinne said, did I seriously just hear one of your panelists say that it's confusing to a soldier what to do when their commanding officer orders them to go in and slaughter women and children?
That's what happened in the My Lai massacre, and soldiers used that defense. And Lieutenant Kelly was convicted, of course, and but that did happen. World War II.
Yeah.
How many German soldiers at Nuremberg said, I was just following orders when I ordered those
You're
people?
You're taught to follow orders all day, every day.
I mean,
no matter what they tell you, you have to do. You want to get up at 4 in the morning and do 1,000 push-ups?
Right.
That's, you follow orders. That's
what
that
you're
taught in
the
military.
Yeah, that was their defense. I don't think it's appropriate, but it is difficult for a rank-and-file soldier when he's he or she are told what to do, and it's contradictory.
Well, each rank and file soldier gets the orders and say, well, is that constitutional? Maybe we should all talk about it. Is that constitutional?
Right.
Let's have a debate.
Yeah, it is problematic.
Tommy writes, tired. You're tired of all this. I'm energized. I'm energized that we are discovering the take two. I'm energized that we are discovering the cracks in our democratic system and in our Constitution, and perhaps they can be repaired.
I hope so.
I love you, Tommy. Just saying.
Some really good caulk could help.
Yes,
actually.
That's right. It certainly could. Does anyone else find it ironic that the Trump administration has had a sweeping demand to strip any mention of DEI in government policies and documents, claiming that anyone who is appointed to a federal position from a minority group is, by default, incompetent, but then turns around and appoints Halligan as a federal state attorney with absolutely no qualifications for the job?
These are just excuses. It's just excuses to exert power and control, get a bunch of money, and get a bunch of power. They're just excuses. Anti-Semitism, DEI, these things have been used like bludgeons by the administration.
and in really inappropriate ways, which is not to say that anti-Semitism doesn't exist, or that, you know, bias doesn't exist, or non-bias doesn't exist. These things have just been used as tools, in my opinion.
We get this letter. We got this letter from Dwayne, who says Republicans keep saying government doesn't work. Well, I guess it doesn't when they are in charge. As for Mark Kelly, Diane says in the letter from the Department of Defense, it says towards the end of the statement, presumed lawful. Doesn't that poke a hole in the argument for a court-martial, or will it be taken broadly?
A tough one.
I think it's a great question to leave out there for people to tackle and come back to, do some homework and respond, but a good question nonetheless.
Yeah. Back on the Ukraine thing, it is another example of how a lot of Republicans are disagreeing with Trump's abandonment or would-be abandonment of Zelensky and Ukraine under the original way this peace proposal was rolled out. More and more members of Congress are speaking up and criticizing the administration softly, but asserting their support for Ukraine. So there's a lot going on right now where Republicans are beginning to follow the lead of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Is that right?
Yes, right. Let's see. We go to Duncan, who says, Mark Kelly, Comey. I think I read that letter, actually. My apologies. And I think I have I concluded that the letter portion of our have I finished everything I had in? So what I do is they come into me and then they're put into a folder and then I read from the folder. And sometimes I'm not always good at taking things out of the folder. Mike says, imagine France threatening to remove support of the colonies and bullying them into capitulation or surrender during the revolution, a war that went on for over 7 years. That firm, Mike in Clifton Park.
Yeah, Mike.
Let's see. Guys, no. The problem here is that we, the American people, are succumbing to the false belief that Putin is negotiating in good faith. He is not. Any attempt at a quote-unquote peace deal is similar to attempts at appeasing Hitler before World War II. Putin is already the fascist dictator that Trump wants to be. Putin is fooling us all.
Well, I think that's true, but I also think Fran is right. A peace deal, or maybe this is JP, a peace deal is better than war, and so you have to keep trying. That writer is absolutely right that Putin holds, 50 out of the 52 cards here? That is to say, he doesn't have to agree with the outcome of the negotiation. He can continue to fight. And in fact, in some ways, I think he'd prefer to continue to fight. But you still have to make the effort. And so I appreciate what the administration is trying to do.
You still have to make the effort, and then the peace deal has to be better than actually being at war. I mean, those are the two things you have to do. If the peace deal isn't better than being at war, what are you doing?
We are out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us and for our terrific panel, Fran Berman, Bo Breslin, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller. You're all wonderful. I appreciate you being here. Have a beautiful holiday, and we will see you next time. As for you, dear listeners, we have another hour of this program, and we will commence right after this short break.